Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. We've reached episode number 4. So thank you so much to everyone who has supported the podcast so far and enjoyed the 3 episodes to now. What I wanted to do with this episode was to speak about the film The Northman, which I had the pleasure of watching over the weekend. I had some other ideas for topics to discuss lined up. In fact, I've got quite a few, but I really enjoyed The Northman, and I think there's quite a lot to say about it. Not all good. And I thought with this podcast, I'd just hit record and talk about it. And I've got a few very, very vague notes of things that I wanted to touch upon. But for the most part, this is going to be quite free form. And well, let's see where it goes. So, first of all, there will be spoilers in this, so if you haven't seen The Northman, then perhaps you might want to put this episode aside for a later time after you have watched it. Although, you know, and from this point on, please don't listen any further, but if you are still listening, it probably won't be news to you that The Northman is based upon basically Hamlet. It's Ambale's saga, which is one of the more well-known Icelandic sagas, which itself was an inspiration for Hamlet. And that is apparently, I've not actually read the saga myself, but that is the saga which The Northman is based on. I've not read or seen anyone else's reviews or takes on The Northman other than a guy called Thomas Sheridan, which some of you might be familiar with. Thomas, he's an Irish guy who he's an Irish pagan, and he's someone whose work I've followed for many years, probably around 10 years since I think he did a couple of interviews on Red Ice Radio before Red Ice went kind of down the alt-right route, when Red Ice was more focused upon sort of the wider kind of conspiracy arena of topics. And I think at the time, Russell Brand was becoming quite popular, and I think Thomas Sheridan had some kind of concept where he called Russell Brand the purple pill, because he was kind of giving aspects of the red pill as well as aspects of the blue pill of, famous Matrix lore. But anyway, I'll come back to Thomas later on, because there were a couple of points that he made which I'd like to either comment upon or perhaps even echo. I would actually highly recommend checking out Thomas's video on The Northman, because it's well worth listening to his take on it. So the story, in a nutshell, is about a young prince called Amleth, whose father, King Orvandil, is murdered by his uncle, Fjolnir, and the young Amleth manages to escape the scene of the crime, and he flees, and he becomes a kind of, member of a roving manabund in the Ruslands in Russia. But the whole time he's held within him this desire, this long-term desire to go back and wreak revenge upon what happened to his father and his mother. So eventually he finds out where his uncle is living now, which is in Iceland. He's resettled, I think, presumably from the Danish lands. I think it begins in Denmark. He resettles from Denmark to Iceland, and Amleth finds him there by pretending to be a slave, a Slavic slave, and he's taken there. And he becomes intertwined with one of the others, one of the Slavic slaves, a woman called Olga, and between them they kind of they assist one another, or she assists him in planning to plot his revenge, and it kind of ends quite kind of catastrophically. So I don't even think that by mentioning that overview of the story, I don't even think that I'm really spoiling it, because anyone who's probably shown an interest in the film knows that it's based on Hamlet. And, you know, Hamlet's a very well-known archetypal story. So I don't think that there are a great deal of spoilers there. But, you know, the things I'll go on to talk about now may be considered more as spoilers. So I suppose an obvious area of topics for me to get onto is the pagan, deeply pagan nature of the film. It is undoubtedly a very pagan film. I'm just going to, I've made notes of some of the more prominent, events and aspects and occurrences that happen. There are strong shamanic themes throughout. When Amleth is a young boy, his father has returned home from some kind of conquest or something. His father takes him one night into a it seems like a kind of like a basement sort of area, where they conduct a kind of rite of passage where both of them, the father and the son, act as dogs, or wolves, overseen by a shaman called Hamir, I think his name is, who is played by Willem Dafoe. And it's a very, it's a really wacky scene. It's, you've got the kind of madness of this shamanic character, Hamir, dressed in very kind of typical, almost barbaric shamanic, clothing, all lit up by fire and candlelight only, whilst King Orvindil and Amleth are, on their bellies lapping up, I think it's mead or ale from a bowl. And this is clearly, in the story, this plays the role of, inducting Amleth into his princehood, to know that although he comes from this very, he comes from this from kingship, from a royal family, he also has to retain that wildness within him, because that's what the Norsemen of the time, it was still valued, no matter where your standing was in society. The ability to revert to a wild state was very much revered. So they had this rite of passage, and interestingly, when we don't see a great deal of Amleth as a boy, but after his father is killed by his uncle Fjolnir, Amleth immediately flees by boat across the sea, and then kind of the next thing we see of him is he's kind of half naked, amongst other warriors in Russia, with a, I believe at that moment he has a wolf cowl on. If not, it's around that time. But he is very much looking like the wolf or the dog that he was. His father compelled him to be with this early rite of passage, and Amleth at this point is essentially living as a warrior within a Koryos, or a roving manabund. He's amongst this kind of band of presumably other Norsemen who were raiding Russia for women and for riches and just for glory. And Amleth is clearly a formidable character at this point. You know, his ability with a sword, his fighting ability, and his physique are incredibly impressive. And I think it's at this moment that you really notice how incredible the sets and the costumes and just the general feel of the film are, the authenticity of it in terms of how it looks, are really quite incredible. So, yeah, you have this roving Manabund, and it's during this time that Amleth discovers that his uncle is still alive and is now living in Iceland. So he finds himself, I think it's in Russia, he finds himself... he wanders off and kind of comes, encounters this seeress woman played by Bjork, and she basically confirms through her spiritual means that Amleth's uncle Fjolnir is still alive in Iceland. So you have this very pagan aspect, which is something which is expressed well in Völuspá, from the Poetic Edda, the power of the seeress in Norse law, and their ability to convey information that, you know, with our modern senses should not be possible to convey. Throughout the film, there are two or three times where Amleth has visions of Yggdrasil, and they're these very surreal, trippy kind of playthroughs he has of seeing the tree and it's the way that it moves and kind of pulsates. And in these visions, he sees that which he is interlinked to, and he kind of sees his fate and sees what he should be aspiring to. Again, incredibly powerfully pagan and I would argue authentic, portrayals of Norse paganism there. He clearly, throughout his life, he has a sense of the interconnectedness and of the law of weird, of what should be based on what has passed. I've said this before, I've mentioned it before, but some people mistake weird as meaning fate, but it's not quite the same thing as fate, because weird depends on what has come before, and it does still allow for the individual to make choices. It's just that those choices that are available to the individual are predetermined by the actions that have been taken in the past. So you're not completely powerless in the direction that your life goes in, but you are power. You don't have access to every available option. You have a certain set of options which are which come before you that you have to choose from. Based on not just your past, but your family's past, your clan's past, your those that you're close to. The decisions that they've made also impact what you're able to do in the future. Later on in the film, when Amleth comes to finally confront his uncle, the way that he creates chaos within the camp on Iceland, and they all believe that he's a slave. The way that he creates the chaos is by lacing their ale with fly agaric mushroom, psychedelic mushroom, which makes them all both quite sick and also begin to hallucinate and completely incapable of putting up a defense for their lord. A knowledge of the knowledge of the fly agaric and of its psychedelic effects. This is again, this is something very shamanic, something very pagan. And it was a very welcome scene, I think, and from the maker, from the director, Robert Eggers. And I can't remember who actually wrote the scripts and everything, but their willingness to include all of these very surreal, very what would be abstract to most people. And this is, you know, this is something which you know, just as a kind of an aside here, I saw this film advertised on the side of buses, and I think the catch line was "this generation's Gladiator." That's what it was being sold as. And it really, I can't really think of a much less fitting description for it, even though it has some great action and some really bloody violence in it, and it is a revenge story, as Gladiator is. The style of it is completely different, and I can't really imagine many Gladiator fans, many who watched and enjoy Gladiator, quite grasping The Northman. But anyway, overall, the film really brings together these ideas of, you know, destiny or weird with duty and honor, you know, these very heathen concepts, which were valued greatly by the men of Viking times. You know, what Amleth succeeds in doing throughout the film is not only does he fulfill what he believes is his unavoidable destiny, by making choices along the way to take him closer to that destiny, in getting revenge, but he also upholds duty. He upholds his own honor. He manages to secure his family line because he does impregnate Olga, and he, after making sure that she has a secure future, he then returns to his course of destiny. And succeeds in gaining revenge. And one of the most kind of spine-tingling moments in the film, and yeah, I mean, you know, again, we're into spoiler territory here, but at the very end of the film, there's this like stunningly ethereal depiction of the gate of Valhalla, this kind of this bright light portal in the sky where Amleth, you know, the insinuation is that Amleth ascends to Valhalla because he dies defending his honor in battle. And it's you know, it sent chills down my spine. Throughout the film, we have depictions of blot and prayer. There is human sacrifice. When Fjolnir's son, Thorir, dies, I think, if I remember rightly, he is to be buried, or I don't think they actually show how he is, disposed of, so to speak, but a woman lays down her life with him, and she's singing as she does it in a very mournful manner. So it does depict human sacrifice. And lastly, there are visions of Odin on at least one occasion, as well as I think when the gates of Valhalla appear, there is a momentary glimpse of Odin. So my own thoughts on the film are, it's artistically very stunning. I mean, that's the first thing that strikes you. And this is a mainstay of, or a staple of Robert Eggers' style. You know, the artistry that goes into the film, that the atmosphere that he creates, the performances that come from the actors, the authenticity of the sets, it really, really draws you in. You know, there is nothing Marvel or Hollywood about this film whatsoever, and I think that's one of the reasons that it's been so well received by the genuine heathen community, and perhaps the kind of dissident or nationalist community. There are other reasons which I'll go into later, but one of the reasons is because it is the anti-Marvel. You know, it's depicts Viking life so contrastingly different to how it's depicted by the Marvel films. For me, one of the things that always strikes me about films, and this also goes for music as well, this is a realization that I've had recently, is that rather than remembering lyrics or lines or even, dare I say, the storyline of a film or of a TV show or an album, what I remember most is the emotions which it inspires within me, the feelings, the atmosphere that it brings, and those things stay with me far longer. Those kind of more abstract, the things that it leaves you with, it leaves me with those feelings more than it leaves me with a sense of the story or the or specific quotes or anything like that. So it's because of its authenticity, the authenticity of the sets and the costumes, and because of the performances and the landscapes that are that it's set within, they're so atmospheric. The lighting that's used, you know, when the scenes are set in moonlight, it seems, I may be wrong in saying this, maybe it's genuine, but it seems as though the director or the makers of the film deliberately pulled all of the color out, so it becomes almost this kind of sepia black and white during these scenes of moonlight. It could be that that's actually how it looked, because moonlight obviously can give that kind of feel to objects. But the feeling of those scenes, I've been kind of wrestling with how to describe this, because, you know, and hopefully some of you know what I'm talking about when I say this, but when I was younger and I used to go out on like a Friday night, what I used to do is me and some friends, we'd get a couple of beers, we'd walk up to some woods, we'd take a portable stereo, and we'd usually be listening to like 90s Norwegian black metal or something, but we'd sit there until the early hours under firelight, and the fire would die down, and sometimes we'd camp over in the woods, and we'd sit there talking, maybe playing acoustic guitar or listening to music. The fire would die down, maybe the music would stop, and what you'd be left with is just everything bathed in moonlight, and the feel of the world changes in those moments. The way that you feel, there's almost like a feeling of drunkenness, even if you've not been drinking alcohol. You know that your kind of your sense of normality slips away. Your sense of almost your sense of balance. You know, the world starts to spin. You kind of get this very hazy outlook on the world. And in watching The Northman, some of these scenes took me straight back to those feelings, to those times. And I think that's initially one of the things I was so grateful to it for, was the way that it almost made me nostalgic for things I've experienced in my life, even though I've never been a slave, a Russian slave who's been carried across to Iceland to avenge my father. I've never been in battle. You know, I've not experienced literally the things that Amleth or other characters experience. But somehow, because of the settings that they find themselves in, it feels like home. It feels like something that I've experienced. And this is purely because of the atmosphere that was imbued into it by the director, by the cinematographer, by the lighting engineers, by the composer of the score. So those are the biggest positives for me. There are other positives, but I want to speak about them in a more general way, because they're things which I think are part of a wider discussion which people are having about this film, and topics related to film in general. So, excuse me. Thomas Sheridan, who I mentioned earlier, his video is based around his belief that this film was essentially an own goal for the woke establishment. He says, that this they didn't mean to let a film of this caliber and of this power out. They didn't know what they were doing when they allowed it to be made and allowed it to turn out the way that it did. And I think there's a lot to be said for this point of view, because it's hard as a heathen and a dissident not to see this film and just feel that it was something utterly refreshing compared to what else you might find in the cinema over the last 10, 20 years. To have a film which has no woke token casting of you know, non-European actors or actresses to tick boxes. There's no diversity hires in the film. It is, I mean, the two main characters, Amleth and Fjolnir, are both Scandinavian actors. There are many other Scandinavian actors. There are English, British actors in the film. There's Nicole Kidman, who is Australian, I believe, but obviously of Northwest European descent. I think Thorir, Fjolnir's son, is also Swedish himself. King Orvandil is played by Ethan Hawke, who is obviously an Anglo-American. There's Willem Dafoe. There's some brilliant casting in it, and some very authentic casting, I think. Everyone who acted in it played their role brilliantly. I mean, I could make comments about Nicole Kidman's face job, which my wife couldn't let pass without comment while we were watching the film. And yeah, once you see it, you can't unsee it. But that's about the worst thing I can say about the cast. But yeah, I think it was a bit of an own goal for the establishment. There are people in the dissident sphere who would argue otherwise, and I'll get onto that point in a minute. But it's a balls out portrayal of North European heathenry, unapologetic, unashamedly, ethnically Northern European heathen film based on legitimate source material, and with very authentic music costumes, sets, as I've mentioned. So from a kind of technical point of view, it really can't be faulted for anyone who is looking for a film about paganism, and not a bastardization of paganism, but I'm sure liberties were taken, and I'll perhaps go on to that in a minute, but it is, I think the best word that I could use to describe it is unapologetic. And at this point in our kind of modern history of modern entertainment and our descent into Kali Yuga and of, you know, degenerate media entertainment, it's difficult to expect more than we got from the Northmen. We'll be right back. So that was another of my songs. That was called Hunted. That's by my project Walkensman. And if you're wondering, yes, most of the songs that I feature in this podcast probably will be my own. And that's not a vain thing whatsoever. It's purely because I know that I don't need to ask for the rights to use those songs. I also think, if I may be so bold, I do think that many of you listening may not be aware that I am a musician too. And perhaps you've not come across my music. So maybe it's a good opportunity for you too. Or maybe you just skip straight across it, which is fine. You know, I won't take offense to that whatsoever. It may not be your kind of thing. But anyway, that's what I do when I, on the rare occasion that I find time amidst my busy schedule. So back to the Northmen, and what I'd like to go through now briefly is the bad, you know, what I didn't like about it, or what we could perhaps see as a negative. I think a good point that I saw someone make, and you know, forgive me, but I can't remember who said this, but it's a great point. There's very little competition for a film like this. So, you know, when we think about pagan films, there aren't many at all. There are films which have brief depictions of paganism in them. Even, you know, Prince of Thieves, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves has kind of a bit of kind of satanic witchcraft, which could be, you know, seen as somewhat pagan. You've got the Robin of Sherwood series, which is quite overtly pagan, actually, but that's not a film. And that was quite a long time ago. A film like Excalibur, which is one of my favourite films of all time, I would argue has strong pagan themes in it, purely by virtue of being based on Indo-European themes. So although it does have this Grail mythos, kind of, you know, search for the Grail and everything that comes with that, which is a lot of Christian lore, I would say that those archetypal ideas harken back to a pagan mythos. So for me, I would actually consider Excalibur a pagan film, and that's how I view it. But if we're talking about the last few decades, there are so few films on par with The Northmen, which depict paganism so unapologetically, that I think you could say that people like us have been hungry for a film like this. So anything that comes along which is vaguely in that ballpark is going to be, you know, lapped up like a pool of water in the Sahara. You know, we've been thirsting for it for a long time, and perhaps that has skewed our more objective judgment of the film. The major, I mean, in terms of the actual kind of, as a film to enjoy, it's not a particularly fast-paced film. It's not like the kind of thing you'd see from Michael Mann or one of these big Hollywood action film directors with these, you know, this, like, you know, every scene in sequence is basically a new action set piece, or, you know, full of these kind of like one line, you know, quick witted quotes. It's obviously not that kind of film. It's more of a slow burner, and it needs to be for its authenticity. So as my friends and I would describe it, it's a nose breather. It's the kind of film that you sit there quietly sipping on a, you know, like a glass of wine or a fine beer or a whiskey or something, just, you know, being dragged deep into that screen. Although that's a dangerous thing to say, really, isn't it? Being dragged into the screen. And I'll get to that later as well. But it is an engrossing film, even though it is at times quite slow. But the main criticism, which I've seen people make of it, is that it is somehow anti-white. Now, I don't personally like using the term white because I think it downplays the various ethnicities and identities that we have in the world. But for the sake of getting the point across here, I will use that word. It's some people have accused it of being anti-white in the sense that throughout the film, what you're presented is essentially a very dark, dim, barbaric, primitive Northern Europe where people live in these very, very rustic wooden or stone dwellings, where there are very, very few comforts or amenities, where life is hard, where violence is the norm, and you know, Vikings go a Viking and they literally slaughter villages of people and rape their women, and where spirituality amounts to this kind of very bestial shamanic practice. Literally, the main characters are acting as beasts at times in the film. That they're lustful, that they're filthy, that they're unkempt, that they have no higher morals, that there's very little joy. I mean, to the latter point, as to the nature of the storyline, of course, I mean, you can read Hamlet, and from what I remember of reading Hamlet, there are very few moments of joy in that as well. You know, sometimes a story just lends itself to a certain demeanor, and The Northman definitely has a grim demeanor to it for the most part. There are some quite amusing moments here and there, and there are definitely expressions of love and loyalty in the film. And that's one of the arguments that I would make against that point. If you feel that the film depicts a horrendous, European past, then I would suggest that perhaps you have quite a different vision for Europe from a lot of people. To me, I didn't look at that film and think, wow, that's really not the kind of place that I would like to exist. For me, I actually felt nostalgic for it. Yeah, and I speak as generally someone who's quite kind of who avoids violence generally unless it's necessary, who doesn't eat meat. You know, I generally lead quite a peaceful lifestyle. I'm not afraid of violence, and you know, I'll meet it out when and where necessary, but it's not something that I revel in. Yet this, the Europe depicted, the Scandinavia, Iceland and Scandinavia and Russia that's depicted in The Northman is a wild, open, expansive world where men and women still have the ability to make a name for themselves. They still have that freedom uninhibited by, unnecessary law and bureaucracy, and overpopulation and over-socialization. And I think that's a world which many of us do kind of long for. And it probably speaks to a bigger debate as to whether we actually value civilization as we know it, or whether we feel that civilization is actually something of an inhibitive force, that it actually may prevent us from living as we naturally should, from seeing our true potential as men, as spiritual men and women. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that. You know, life then was hard. Life is hard now still. You know, it's just hard in a different way, I would argue. And at least back then, although you had the hardship of no access to running, of plumbed running water, although your village could be attacked by a roving manabund, at any moment, it remains true that you had the ability to defend yourself against them, and you weren't inhibited by the law from doing that. You were able to test your mettle as a man. And I think that's something to be cherished. That's something that we... that's definitely something which we could take aspects of into our future, that we need to. I think if we become over-civilized, then actually we're just going to see more of what's bad with the world now. You know, people talk about our civilization is dying at the moment, you know, within this post-scandemic world. But I actually argue the opposite. I say that what's occurring is an excess of civilization. With the rise in technology, of especially of digital technology, that's taking over our lives, we're seeing an over-civilized people. And I think that's going to be to our detriment more than would be if we were less civilized. I also think that those who have made these criticisms of the film as portraying, you know, white Northern Europeans as savages, I think it often depends on whether they themselves, these pundits, whether they are pagan or not, or indeed whether they're even spiritual or not. See, you can look at a scene like the bestial impersonations of wolves by firelight, drinking out of bowls on the floor like dogs. You can look at that as a portrayal of bestial men and women, or you can, as a pagan, you can see that as, well, our ancestors believed, and we should perhaps believe, if we consider ourselves heathens too, that it is possible to take on aspects of an animal. The kind of archetypal character of the wolf or the bear, or indeed the serpent, or of the eagle, or, you know, of, you know, various other animals. These animals were closely linked to the gods. Obviously, Woden himself had his two wolves, Geri and Freki, his two ravens, Hugin and Munin. Freya's chariot is pulled by cats. There are animals have been intrinsically linked to our customs and our gods for a long time, and it's true that our ancestors would have sought to take on those characteristics at certain times for certain reasons. And when you are an adherent of a spiritual worldview which sees yourself and your folk as at being at one with nature, then isn't it natural to embrace those bestial aspects as long as we have them under control? And I would say, Rather than say that we need to balance out those bestial instincts with more civilized ones, I would say that our ancestors, much like us, realized that they were, as men and women, they were too civilized at times, and that they actually needed to make a concerted effort to become more bestial, or to maintain that balance between wild and civilized. And that's what these rites were about. You know, I don't really know what objections someone could make to portrayals of shamanism. You know, the kind of guttural throat singing, Galda, that's portrayed in the film. If someone views that as being, you know, somehow, you know, degenerate, I don't really know what to say to them, because, well, why? What's degenerate about it? You are using the human body in a very natural manner. And as long as we have a grasp over how our natural ways, rather than being overtaken by them, I would say that there is an immense amount of power in that. If you're an atheist, it's very difficult to understand these pagan rituals. It's very difficult to see why people performed these rites, why they dressed in certain ways, why they wore wolf cowls, why they sprinkled blood upon a gathering at Blot, why there was human sacrifice at times. Now, I'm not going to say whether the human sacrifice portrayed in the film is actually authentic or not. What I would point to is that the way that the woman who's being sacrificed, the actress, performs that scene in a wonderful way, I would say, because you can see both a sense of pride on her face as well as a sense of foreboding. So she wasn't made to sacrifice her life. She did it willingly. That doesn't mean that she went to the blade with a smile on her face necessarily. It would be strange if she did, but she understood the power of what she was doing. Her worldview enabled her to embrace death with dignity. These are things which are very difficult for us to understand in our modern mindset. Really, really difficult. And particularly those who've criticized the film, who come from either perhaps a Christian or an atheist, materialist worldview themselves. It's particularly difficult for them, even though we know that in the Old Testament, Jehovah asks, I think it's Isaac, to sacrifice his firstborn son. Of course, he then says, oh, no, I'm just joking. I just wanted to test your faith. But Isaac was prepared to do it. And the very fact that Jehovah expected that obedience from his followers just goes to show that he is no less barbaric than our heathen ancestors or the expectations of our gods and goddesses are. As I say, it's just, I think the best answer we can give to this criticism of the film is that with our modern mindset, it's very difficult to sympathize with the mindset of our pagan ancestors. But just because we don't understand it, that doesn't make it wrong. And rather, we should be looking to what the film glorifies. Let's go through that quickly. It glorifies loyalty. It glorifies honor. It glorifies the bond between father and son, of family, of being willing to sacrifice yourself for not only your mother and your father, but your future progeny. It celebrates the human body. The male form is depicted of the Northern European is depicted as being impressive, muscular, functional. The wiles and the cleverness of Amleth in how he goes about seeking his revenge and fulfilling his destiny, his determination, these are all admirable traits. The closeness with which people lived to the land, with nature, how they lived in accordance with it, these are positive things. You know, we shouldn't be focusing entirely on the more savage aspects of the film. They're there, but perhaps we might consider that they, in portraying both the savage and the beautiful, the noble and the barbaric, what we're actually being given is a far more fulfilling depiction of life than what we have now, warts and all. You know, rather than this kind of sanitized existence that we have now, where none of us have the opportunity to even seek revenge and stake our place in Valhalla, because there is literally nothing worth fighting for tangibly, or there's no one to fight with. And even if there were, we'd be prevented from doing it by, you know, bureaucracy and law. You know, we live in a very domesticated way in our modern times. Is that better? You know, domesticated means that we're also, less vulnerable to the threats of plunder and of death, of being brutally murdered in our sleep, of dying of sicknesses which could be prevented by modern healthcare and amenities. It means those. It means we lose those things, but we also lose the aspirations of greatness, the freedom, the sense of honor, the spiritual worldview that our ancestors had. So I think we need to take it as a package and realize that the package that's portrayed in The Northman is a rich, comprehensive, deeply, you know, evocative way of life, which we can only hope to achieve again if we surrender some of the civilizing ways that we have today. Those dissidents, particularly on the right, who would seek only to become more civilized, I think that they are probably seeking something different to what I'm seeking. And perhaps, you know, maybe there's even a discussion to be had here about those people who criticize the film may also be the same kind of people who secretly or not so secretly embrace this kind of technocratic reset that the world is in the beginning stages of now. Because this new technocratic society will remove all danger, all unknowns, all mystery from life. And by it's becoming more civilized in that sense. Whereas myself, I'm seeking to retain that mystery in life. I'm seeking to gain more freedom, a closer relationship with the natural world, less bureaucracy, less law, less man-made law. I'm seeking to move towards those things, and I dare say that some of you listening may also be seeking those things too. So yeah, struggle has always existed. It exists now, it existed then, but there was a larger scope for experience, I think, in the times that were depicted in The Northman. This podcast has actually gone on a bit longer than I expected it to be honest. I thought this was going to be quite a short one, but we're at nearly an hour now, I think. So there was one last discussion that I wanted to bring up, which I'll just go into very briefly, maybe for just 10 minutes or so. This is the argument that we shouldn't even be watching films. Now, someone popped up in my Telegram comments to say that watching films is a worthless pursuit. It's a waste of time. There's a podcast which I have been a fan of for years called Crow 777. And the host of that podcast, a point that he regularly makes is that the word entertainment etymologically means, you can break it down into enter, tain, ment. Enter, to enter. Tain, to hold. Ment means mind. So entertainment etymologically means to enter and hold the mind. And he uses this as an argument that we probably shouldn't be watching films, because when we do, the creators of that film and all of their intentions that come with it enter our mind, hold it for the duration of that film and beyond. And that's not something that we should be giving willingly. Now, I partly agree with that in the sense that 95% of entertainment out there is not only worthless, but is probably designed to pervert our minds, to waste our time, to reprogram our values. But a film like The Northman is not one of them. Nor would I argue as a film like Excalibur. There are several other films that I'm not going to go into them, because it's a matter of opinion, really, as to, and it depends on your own perspective in life and your worldview, as to how worthy these films are of our attention. But what I would say is that even a film like 300, which doesn't have any of the authenticity of The Northman, what it does, it still stirs something within you. 300 is essentially a nationalistic film, as was Braveheart, as it was even the even that I think it was in the 2000s, King Arthur with Clive Owen. Again, a very nationalistic film. It's about the native Britons defending their land against the incoming Saxons. There are various of these films which were huge, huge Hollywood films, which are actually in their essence nationalist. The Northman isn't one of them, in the sense that it's not about defending your land against an incoming horde, but it is a depiction of honour, of glory, of wild, untamed lands and ways of life, which can stir something within you. You know, when I watched The Northman, it made me proud to be a heathen. It made me proud to be a Northern European, you know, or you know, I'm not of Scandinavian descent, I'm of English and Dutch descent. But my gods are still the same gods. The customs of my ancestors are very similar to what's depicted in the film. And that's something that can give us an immense amount of pride, and we should take that. We should take that with gratitude, rather than looking for holes in the film. We should take that, specifically the feeling that it gives us, what it stirs in us emotionally. We should take that with gratitude. We should use that to empower ourselves moving forward. We should look at a film like The Northman and say, I'm going to grow my hair long. You know, I mean, my hair is already long, but you know, some people viewing it might say, to hell with the rest of society. I'm going to dress more like my ancestors did. And I don't mean in a LARPy way, but I mean, they weren't concerned with having short cropped hair and a side parting and a neatly kempt beard and, you know, wearing a shirt and jeans and smart shoes. Those are not things which were important to them. Obviously, they cared how they presented themselves, but they weren't afraid to appear wild. That's something I think that we can take into our modern mindset, as well as the ideas that, you know, my values align more closely to what is depicted in The Northman, or in 300, or in Braveheart, or in Excalibur, or whatever, you know, film you want to name. My values as a man are closely aligned with those things, and they're not closely aligned with those of modern mainstream society. And if that film stirred something in me, why would I not aspire to act more like the men in that film than the men who I see wearing masks to walk into a coffee shop, wearing pink jeans or whatever, you know? Why would I seek to align more with the current social norm than with what is gloriously depicted in The Northman and other films? That's what it does for me. And if you've not seen the film, but you've still listened to this podcast and you're planning on watching the film, that's what I would suggest you take into the film. You know, open yourself up to the emotional stirrings of the film, of what arises within you whilst watching it, the pride that comes up within you, the sense of kinship that you have with the mindset of these men and women in this film, as opposed to the men and women of our modern times. Seek to be more like them in their good ways, and seek to be less like the men and women out there in our normal society today. That's what I would suggest. That's what I intend to do every time I see a film like this. And it works the same with me for music. Certain music gives me that same feeling. It makes me feel more empowered to be who I naturally am, to speak my mind more honestly than I otherwise would, because in doing so, I am behaving more like the men portrayed in these films or the sentiments expressed in the lyrics of songs I listen to. I'm behaving more like them. And those are things that I value. I don't value the men and women who I see day to day out there on the streets, behaving like good domesticated slaves with no sense of spiritual purpose whatsoever. I don't aspire to be anything like them. So why do I pretend to? Why would I pretend to? Why would any of us pretend to want to be like them when we could be like ourselves? We could be like the men and women in these films, which stir something powerful within us. So I'll end it on that. And lastly, before I go today, it's time for me to do the riddle section. So if you'll just bear with me, I hope you enjoyed this discussion of the Northman anyway. And I hope that if you have not yet seen it, that I've kind of compelled you to make the effort to watch it. Or perhaps you have seen it and you agree or disagree with anything I've said, and that's great. You know, please come to my Telegram channel, leave some comments in response to the post about it. I'd love to hear your thoughts on all of this. Yeah, I'd be very much interested in hearing your thoughts. So this is episode 4 of the Fergan podcast, and this is the answer to riddle number 3 from last week's podcast, from episode number 3. So, riddle number 3 described a storm, quite simply. So, essentially, the first 3 riddles have all described storms of some kind. The first riddle was a storm on land, the second riddle was a storm at sea, and the third one is more generally just a storm. So, yeah, I'm sure some of you got that right, although the answer probably seemed too simple to some of you. So here we go for riddle number 4. So give this some thought, and next week in the next podcast, in episode number 5, I will reveal the answer to this riddle. Ring me, they ring me. I work long hours and must eagerly obey my thane. Break my rest and loudly proclaim that my guardian gave me a halter. A man or a woman, weary and bleary, has often called on me, winter cold. I answer them, surly as they are. Sometimes a warm limb releases the bound ring, but it delights my thane, a dull sort of man, and satisfies me into the bargain, if anyone can fathom and solve my riddle. There you go. So this was episode number 4 of the Fergan podcast, and thank you for joining me. And thank you for listening, and a special thanks to those who are supporting the work that I'm doing. It's very much appreciated, and I'll be looking to design some Fergan merchandise soon. That's my day job, actually, as a designer, often of merchandise, so hopefully I can come up with some stuff that you guys and girls appreciate and would actually like to wear. So stay tuned to the website, Fergan, FYRGEN.com, and also the Telegram channel, which is my most active platform. And be well, and I will speak to you all in the next podcast.